Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 10th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the reach of federal warrants and the Microsoft case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them of about 5 to 10 to 12 minutes or so, maybe a little bit of back and forth, and ultimately, as always, we'll be turning to our audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. We're going to hear first today from James M. Garland. He's a partner at Covington & Burling, and he'll be followed in opening remarks by David Howard. Mr. Howard is Corporate Vice President and Deputy General Counsel at Microsoft. So let's get started. Mr. Garland, the floor is yours.
Dean, thanks very much. Nice to be on the phone with you all today. I'm pleased to talk a little bit about Microsoft's challenge of a federal search warrant that was served on it back in late 2013, issued by the Southern District of New York, that sought emails that were stored in a Microsoft data center located in Dublin, Ireland. Maybe I'll begin by talking a little bit about the relevant law governing the law enforcement's ability to obtain emails. The statute in question that's the relevant statute for this case is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which was enacted in 1986 at a time when email was really in its nascent stages and certainly no U.S.-based electronic communication service providers stored communications data outside the United States at all, and really the Internet was really not even developed yet. Under that statute, the government is authorized to require the disclosure of the contents of communications only pursuant to a search warrant. Issued by an independent magistrate judge upon a showing of probable cause. ECPA, as it's known, also provides that certain non-content records, such as basic subscriber information about an email subscriber, can be accessed by the government via subpoena, which is a much lesser showing. And then in the middle between sort of the most basic subscriber information on the one end, and then the contents of the communications on the other end is sort of other types of non-content data like transmission logs and things of that nature, which are accessible by what's called a D order under ECPA. And that's sort of an order that you have to go to a judge to obtain if you're law enforcement, but you need not show probable cause. In 2010, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that notwithstanding other provisions of ECPA that might provide the ability to access content data through something less than a search warrant, that the Fourth Amendment actually required a warrant to get all types of email content. And so ever since 2010, the government has essentially always obtained a search warrant when it wants to seize emails in conducting criminal investigations. So that leads me then to Microsoft. Microsoft, as everyone knows, has for many years run free web-based email services. Hotmail is what it was formerly called. It's now called Outlook.com, but it's had other iterations under different names. And beginning in about 2010, Microsoft started to host or store email content for its free web-based email services at data centers outside the United States for the first time. And formerly, it had been only stored inside the United States. In 2010, it opened a data center in Dublin, Ireland, and began to move Hotmail accounts at the time to Dublin for storage there. And it didn't move all Hotmail accounts to Dublin, Ireland. It moved it started to store Hotmail accounts in Dublin, Ireland, that were associated with users who were near Dublin, Ireland, as opposed to near data centers in the United States. And the reason they did that is for technological reasons. There's a phenomenon known as network latency, and that results in inefficient service, poor performance of the email service. based on the distance of the user from the server, from the data center where the email is hosted. And so for certain users located in Europe or Asia, for example, Microsoft decided to host those email accounts in Dublin. Microsoft, as do all other US-based electronic communication service providers, regularly receives compulsory process from law enforcement. When law enforcement, as I mentioned, is seeking contents of communications, law enforcement serves Microsoft with search warrants. So Microsoft regularly complies with search warrants that it receives seeking the contents of its email subscribers' accounts. In late 2013, Microsoft received just such a warrant seeking emails of an account, Microsoft account holder. But these emails, upon review, learned were stored in an account hosted in the Dublin, Ireland data center. Now, this was a search warrant that was issued by a federal magistrate judge in the Southern District of New York. It, on the face of the warrant, made clear that it related to a drug investigation, a drug conspiracy. Microsoft complied with the warrant to the extent that the warrant sought data that was stored in the United States, and there were certain types of data called for by the warrant that were stored in the United States. But for the bulk of the account data, the contents of the data, the actual body of the messages themselves, all of that was stored in Ireland. And so Microsoft moved to vacate the search warrant to the extent it sought the contents of communications stored outside the United States. And the argument that Microsoft advanced in making that motion was pretty straightforward, that there's established case law holding that search warrants are territorially limited instruments of law enforcement power. That is, it's pretty obvious that a magistrate judge in New York City would never be able to issue a search warrant that purports to authorize an FBI agent, for example, to go to Paris, France, and knock down an apartment door to seize evidence in an apartment in France. That search warrant would be a dead letter. So our argument was simply that the government is not able to do, you know, indirectly through Microsoft, co-opting Microsoft to execute the warrant on its behalf, what it is forbidden to do directly, right? And moreover, looking at the statute that requires warrants, nothing in ECPA, nothing in the statute purports to authorize extraterritorial searches and seizures. And there we turn to the more robust body of law that the Supreme Court has decided about the territorial limits of U.S. law and the presumption against the extraterritorial application of U.S. law. And we said, look, nothing in ECPA explicitly says that the warrant power extends overseas. And when Congress wants to apply U.S. law overseas, it has to say so explicitly, and it hasn't done so. And so that, therefore, this warrant does not require Microsoft to execute a search and seizure of email data on the government's behalf for data that's stored overseas. Not surprisingly, the Justice Department, through the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, opposed our motion, and they argued that that notwithstanding the fact that this was a search warrant, that the regular rules applicable to subpoenas apply here. And those rules are that no matter where in the world the data is stored, that so long as the data is within Microsoft's possession, custody, or control, that Microsoft is duty-bound to collect it up and turn it over to the government. And moreover, the government argued that there really was nothing extraterritorial at all about this search and seizure. And that's because even though the data was stored in Ireland, and hosted in Ireland and resided on servers in Ireland, that the data was accessible from the United States, that a technician sitting in Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is headquartered, could easily, with just a few keystrokes, pull the data into a terminal there and bundle it up and turn it over to the government, and therefore there was nothing extraterritorial whatsoever about this. And finally, the government argued that if the Microsoft position were adopted by the court, that this would have catastrophic consequences for law enforcement, and law enforcement would not be able to get easy access to data hosted by U.S.-based service providers, and there would be all sorts of pernicious results. So the motion was argued before the federal magistrate judge who issued the very warrant we were challenging. So the result may not be so surprising. The magistrate judge agreed with the government, and in language of, that was that's pretty striking, held that the even though the Congress used the term warrant in ECPA, and even though what Microsoft was served with was clearly a standard federal search warrant, that really Congress meant hybrid, part search warrant, but part subpoena. And the part that's a search warrant is the part that relates to probable cause showing in a neutral magistrate. But the part that subpoena means that the court could apply the possession, custody, and control rules applicable to subpoenas. And therefore, Microsoft had to go get the data, pull it together, and turn it back over to the Justice Department. So we appealed that ruling of the magistrate judge, and we appealed to the Federal District Court, the Chief Judge Loretta Preska of the Southern District of New York. And after hearing oral argument, she summarily affirmed the magistrate judge's decision from the bench. And so now we've appealed up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the case is being briefed right now. Microsoft, we have submitted our opening brief in the Second Circuit. The government's brief is due next month, and presumably we'll file a reply brief, and oral argument will take place sometime, I'm guessing, in early summer. So that's the procedural posture and the history of the case. It's a very interesting case. There have been a lot of amicus parties that have weighed in on the case, and maybe I'll turn it over now to David for some observations about some of the key issues that are at stake here.
Thanks, Jim. That was a great summary. And as Jim said, I really want to focus on just a few pointed observations about the case. And I think the most important thing to think about when you're thinking about this case is that it's really about a fundamental disconnect between a statute that governs law enforcement access to electronic communication and the needs of a modern society. This statute, as Jim mentioned, was enacted in 1986. And, you know, some of you probably can't think back to 1986 because you weren't alive or you were very young. I unfortunately can remember it. And, you know, what I remember of 1986 was that I lived in a world where my secretary didn't have a computer on her desk, where email was in its infancy, and there was no such thing as AOL or CompuServe or those types of public email services. It was a very different place and a very different world technologically than the one we live in today. The problem with the government's position and the problem with the position that was ultimately adopted by the court was that it's trying to shoehorn this 1986 statute into a world in which email is the most popular and prolific form of communication, both personally and professionally, where people now store literally everything, their entire lives, not only on computers, but in what we call the cloud, in data centers. And that includes not only communications like emails, it includes their personal records, their financial records, their other types of correspondence, photos, and that sort of thing. The most private forms of, the most private parts of people's lives are now stored in the cloud. And that was something that the Supreme Court explicitly recognized and talked about when it decided the Riley cell phone case last year. And obviously, the court and the government have tried to shoehorn the statute into a world in which data centers not only exist, which wasn't true in 1986 so much, but that they exist all over the world. And as Jim said, companies like Microsoft and other email providers have learned that it's necessary to put their data centers near the people who are storing the documents. Not surprisingly, when you try to shoehorn a statute that was passed in a very different world into our modern society, it's not a very good fit. And what the court has done and what the government has tried to do is to essentially take a statute that is pretty clear on its face and rewrite it. And our view, very simply, is that that's a job for Congress. ECPA says that one can get electronic communications contents only pursuant to a warrant. And as Jim said, there are other categories of information that might be included in email that are available upon a lesser showing, either a subpoena or this so-called hybrid court order. And, you know, when you think about it, you can make a very easy analogy to the U.S. mail. In order for the government to get the contents of a letter that's sent between two individuals, it needs a search warrant. That's the most private information. That involves information clearly protected by the Fourth Amendment about which people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And so Congress recognized that and required a warrant. It also said that for lesser forms of information, like, for instance, the name and address of some, the address, the name of somebody who lives at a particular address, or the envelope information in a letter, you know, the sender and the recipient, or in the case of email, you know, the person who sends the email and the person who receives the email. You can get that information upon a lesser showing, either through a subpoena, in the case of basic information like name and address, and through this hybrid court order, in the case of envelope information. So what Congress did made a lot of sense. The problem is that when the court was looking at this particular issue, what it decided was, even though the statute specifically uses the word warrant, Congress meant something other than a warrant, even though it's very clear that Congress had already distinguished between warrants and subpoenas and these hybrid court orders. And we think that's not a decision that the court ought to make. That's really a decision that Congress needs to make. The second way in which ECPA has been contorted in this case is, as Jim mentioned, through this extraterritorial application. The Supreme Court has made it very clear that there is a presumption against extraterritoriality in congressional statutes. And the reason for that is that the court has said, you know, it's got to be completely clear that Congress means for a statute to apply outside the United States, because fundamentally it's a decision of Congress as to whether something ought to affect the relations between the United States and another country. There's a cost associated with saying that a U.S. law is going to apply overseas, and it's not really up to a court to weigh that cost. It's up to Congress. So it has to be completely clear that Congress intended that before a statute will apply extraterritorially. Courts are really poorly suited to make that decision. The problem is that what the court did here was say that even though the law is completely silent about extraterritoriality, it would imply that there was congressional intent to make the statute extraterritorial. And not surprisingly, given the concerns that underlie the presumption against extraterritoriality, the court's decision in this case has provoked outrage by people outside the United States and by governments outside the United States, especially in Europe. The Irish government actually filed an amicus brief in support of our Second Circuit brief. And, you know, we've had letters from commissioners in the European Union, you know, addressing this issue and talking about the problem when the U.S. government attempts to impose its laws outside U.S. government borders. The other issue, I think, with not giving credit to the presumption against extraterritoriality is that it invites other governments to do the same. And, you know, one of the things that I think is a valid concern that we all should have about a decision where the United States decides to ignore its territorial borders and applies its laws outside the United States is that another country may take the same tack. So if you apply the law that the principle that the United States has applied here, what you have is a situation where you could have another country, like, for instance, the government of Russia, come in and serve on Microsoft or Google or Yahoo in their Moscow offices, the equivalent of a search warrant in Russia. and get the emails of a U.S. citizen stored in the United States without either that citizen knowing about it or without the U.S. government knowing about it. And we think, obviously, that that is something that is something that, that virtually nobody would want. But by the government of the United States taking the position that it has, it certainly creates an opening and moral authority for other governments to take the same position. The third observation that I would make relates to another one of the arguments that the government has made in this case. And that's to get over the point that this is an extraterritorial search. The government has analogized this case to cases in which the government obtains business records of a company by serving a subpoena on that company in the United States. So, for instance, if the government wants to get the sales records of that are located in Microsoft France, the law has been and may continue to be that it can serve a subpoena on Microsoft in the United States because records in Microsoft France are within its custody, control, and possession. And that may or may not continue to be the law as the presumption against extraterritoriality continues to develop. But what the government fails to recognize is that there is a fundamental disconnect between saying that the government can obtain Microsoft business records by serving a subpoena on Microsoft in the United States and saying that that the government can contain your emails by serving a subpoena on Microsoft in the United States. Our position, and it's very clear in our terms of use, is that your emails belong to you. We hold them in what is essentially an electronic lockbox for you and for our other customers. And therefore, they are entitled to a degree of protection that's different from the protection that our business records are entitled to. We think it is a dangerous precedent for the government to take the position that that we effectively own and control and possess your emails. Microsoft's position, I just want to be clear, and I'm going to wrap up in a minute, and then we can have a little bit of further conversation. It's not our position that the Court of Appeals ought to invalidate this warrant. And that there be no further discussion or development of the law in this area. We don't suggest that the government should never be able to access information outside the United States. Our position is that the law that exists right now is not well suited to deal with this 2014-2015 problem. We need new laws that do a better job of striking a balance between protecting public safety and protecting personal privacy in the age in which we live. We need cooperation between the United States and other countries that will ensure that the government gets speedy access to information when it's needed. A few weeks ago, I think everybody is very familiar with the tragedy, the terrorist attack in France. There was actually a request from the government of France through the FBI directed to Microsoft to get email records related to that investigation. And where two countries in an emergency situation cooperated together, and the government of France used appropriate process to obtain information located in that in a data center in that country, Microsoft responded, and Microsoft responded and got the information to the government within 45 minutes. So there are mechanisms out there currently to obtain the type of information that governments need to conduct investigations quickly. We think that there needs to be continued cooperation and continued development of those mechanisms. It's not certainly, while you know, obviously there has not been a whole lot coming out of Congress over the course of the last few years. We are encouraged by the fact that a number of senators and congressmen have taken a look at this issue and are serious about it and want to do something about it. In the last Congress, Senator Hatch introduced legislation that was designed to implement this type of balance and to permit the government to, for instance, obtain emails of U.S. citizens and residents, even if they're stored outside the United States. And that was something that we supported, and we understand that Senator Hatch is considering introducing a similar bill in the short term in this Congress as well. And you know, assuming that it is the same bill, we'll continue to support it. So our view basically is we have a statute that doesn't work for today. The courts ought not to rewrite the statute. That's up to Congress, and we're supportive of congressional efforts to do so in a way that strikes the proper balance.
Very good. This is Dean Reuter again. I do want to get to audience questions, but first I want to check back with Jim Garland to see if there's anything you want to do by way of augmenting your opening remarks since you've heard David Howard's remarks.
Thanks, Dean. No, I think David has really hit a lot of the key sort of big picture issues here about this case. I think it's a consequential case. It's one that we appreciate raises a lot of important issues, and fundamentally, I think, raises an issue that never could have been within the contemplation of Congress when it enacted the operative statute, ECPA, back in 1986. And so I think there is, you know, it cries out for the political branches of our government to make the policy changes that are needed to address the sort of new technological landscape we're confronting. But before, you know, that happens, we contend that the courts are duty-bound to apply the laws on the books, and that would require the warrant here to be given only territorial effect. So I think David did a good job of explaining all of that.
Very good. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for those opening remarks. Let's open it up to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first question, let me just make a quick programming announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll get our regular monthly update on the latest developments at the CFPB. That call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It'll feature Wayne Abernathy and Todd Zawicki. Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the sue and settle phenomenon. Some people claim that federal agencies have been engaging in friendly lawsuits brought by plaintiffs who are interested in expanding the regulatory authority of a given federal agency. The plaintiff sues, the agency settles, and the court, in approving the settlement, actually expands the agency's authority beyond its legal limits as they existed before the suit. That is Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Next week, Teleforum topics include Single Point of Entry, a brand new book by Senator and Judge James Buckley, and a Teleforum on Civil Asset Forfeiture. We'll be adding and moving pieces around, so I urge folks to check in with the Federal Society's website for a more complete calendar. Today, of course, federal warrants, the Microsoft case. We've got three callers with questions, so let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Lenore Ostrowski. I have a general question. I didn't hear you address it, which is, in proposed legislation, would you make a distinction between requests for information that goes to national security and other types of information, that is, criminal investigations? It seems to me that foreign governments or courts might delay enough so that national security would be jeopardized. Is this a rational fear?
David, I'm happy to take a crack at that. Lenore, thanks for the question. It's a great question. The legislation that's been proposed by Senator Hatch and others, and that I think is under discussion again in this Congress, is limited totally to criminal law enforcement requests for information. And the mutual legal assistance treaty process that we think should apply in our case, absent a change in the law, is limited to law enforcement requests for cooperation in criminal investigation. So This is not about national security process or national security investigations. And the reach of criminal search warrants issued under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure really doesn't apply to the instruments of investigative authorities that our government has under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or pursuant to the President's authority under without resort to the courts. So this is really limited to criminal law enforcement.
I see. Thank you.
We got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
I'm just noticing that Section 215 of the Patriot Act is due for renewal on June 1st. If that is not renewed, how would that affect things?
I want you to take a shot at that.
Sure. This is Jim again, and I think it relates to the last question in a way. The Section 215 of the Patriot Act, of course, authorizes bulk collection of metadata, the business records provision of FISA, and it's right. It's up for renewal in June. That really has nothing to do with this case, or the federal search warrant power for criminal investigations. It's limited to non-content data in the first instance, but it's also in the national security space, which, as I said just a moment ago, doesn't relate to the search warrant power. I don't know, David, if you have anything to add on that.
I don't.
It seems that national security and acts of terror on the minds of our audience. What, as the system exists right now, what prevents a terrorist from sort of gaming the system and subscribing to a provider that the terrorist knows houses data outside the territorial limits of the United States so that then his emails can't be discovered? Jim or David, do you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. This is Jim. I'll start, and maybe David, you can chime in. First, it's worth saying that right now, somebody who is intent on storing data outside the reach of U.S. law enforcement is perfectly able to do that. One of the largest email providers in the world is the Russian email company mail.ru, and anyone can sign up for that through the internet. So it is right now possible for people who wish to avoid U.S. legal process to use communication services or store their data outside the United States and beyond U.S. legal process simply by using a foreign-based company. I would say that the impact on the ability to combat crime, of course, that was something that the district court really focused on in ruling in the government's favor. But our view is that there are very significant countervailing policy concerns that work the other way, and primary of those is that foreign countries, all countries, retain the sovereign interests in data stored on their shores, in their shores, and of people, their citizens who have data stored remotely. And, just as the United States would have valid reasons for restricting a foreign government's access to private emails located on U.S. soil, nations overseas, Ireland in this case, has valid reasons for restricting access to private emails located in Irish data centers. There is no requirement in U.S. law for U.S. persons or U.S. companies to store their data locally. And in fact, we think such requirements as other countries have sometimes talked about and are increasingly are legislating are detrimental to the efficient functioning of the economy and of the internet, and we think that the district court's ruling here would encourage foreign governments to sidestep their own commitments under agreements with the United States under these mutual legal assistance treaties and unilaterally seek data stored in the United States from providers that operate in their jurisdiction. So if someone were to store email with a Chinese email provider, that operated data centers here in the United States. The rationale that the government is employing in our case would apply equally in China and allow the Chinese government to go straight to that hypothetical email provider and seize data without telling us and without telling the customer. And so we think that's a knock-on effect of this argument that's really quite dangerous. And we also think more broadly it puts at risk the technology sector, the U.S. technology sector, ability to operate and compete globally. And David mentioned foreign leaders are concerned about this expansive interpretation of ECPA. And there is a real risk that U.S.-based providers will be caught in the middle of conflicting laws between the U.S. and other countries. So, we think those are countervailing considerations that the district court should have taken into account in deciding, that this law enforcement impact issue, was something that was relevant to its interpretation of the statute.
I'd add, Jim, a couple things. First of all, fundamentally, it's unlikely that companies in the United States are going to, store email in data centers located in countries with which we really have no relations. And so I think that is an important point that guards against the risk that we were talking about. The other thing is, I think taking a point you made and taking it in a little bit different direction. If the law stays as the district court has suggested it should, then I think what we're going to see is countries requiring or people wanting to put their emails and other information in data centers from local companies held in those countries. And the result of that will be actually to hurt U.S. ability to get that type of information, which is exactly obviously the opposite of what the government really wants here. And the last point I think goes to this issue, which I think is an important one and a really good question, is really harkens back to what I said a couple minutes ago about the fact that we don't have the right laws on the books. The type of issue that was raised here, which is, what do you do about data centers in countries in which we do have no relations? And as I said, that's not likely to happen, but, that is certainly something that can be dealt with through U.S. legislation and should not be dealt with. The tail ought not to wag the dog here, and we ought not to rewrite a statute that plainly was not written with this in mind in order to deal with that situation, which really ought to be resolved by Congress.
We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I want to go to this next question in a moment. But before we do that, we've mentioned a couple times at the MLATs, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties. I wonder if either one of you could just take 60 seconds and explain what those are to our audience.
Sure. So Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties are bilateral treaties entered into between the United States and other countries. We have about 60 or 70 of them in place right now. And they are exactly as they sound. They are arranged to promote the sharing of evidence and in connection with criminal law enforcement investigations. There's usually a central authority in each country that is responsible for making requests of the other country, and it's sort of formalized process so that in the United States, the prosecutors can send requests overseas, and the overseas authorities domesticate those requests under their own local law, obtain the evidence under their own procedures, and then send it back to the United States for use in U.S. proceedings. And it works in the reciprocal direction when requests come from overseas to the United States.
And that process could have been utilized here, but was not?
That's right. That's right. We have an MLAT in place with the Republic of Ireland, and it works very well. We have evidence in our papers, including an affidavit from the former Attorney General of Ireland, who testified that it works exceedingly well and is very efficient. And in just my own experience, I'm unaware of a MLAT request from the United States ever having been turned down when sent to Ireland.
And I suppose it must be the government's position that that's more cumbersome than the search warrant, so that's why the MLAT process wasn't used here.
That's right. I mean, I think the government's view is, why bother with that when they can just go straight to Microsoft and not have to worry about going through an MLAT process, which, of course, we think is an infringement upon the sovereign interests of Ireland and undermines the whole purpose of an MLAT.
Very good. We've got three questions pending now, so let's turn back to our audience for our next question.
Okay. Yes, my name is Angela Ellison, and that brings me to the question in talking about the treaties. Does the reaching of the information in the Microsoft case, does that relate to or is it opposition of the European Union data protection directive on the disclosure? Hello?
Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, David, do you want to field that one or do you want me to?
No, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so the European Data Protection Directive obviously promotes the very strong privacy interests of in Europe about the protection of data of Europeans that's stored in Europe. We think that some of the reactions that we saw, as David mentioned earlier, from the European Commission and other officials in the EU suggest that the Europeans and the European governments very much would prefer the United States to proceed through the MLAT process rather than unilaterally seize data stored in Europe. And so we think that Microsoft's position in our case is consistent with the European view of their rights under their data protection directives.
Okay. Thanks very much. I asked that question because I know they're very firm under that directive about email content and access to privacy. So thanks so much for your comment, for your response.
Thank you.
Two questions pending. Let me ask, is the government here seeking content from the emails or just the transmission data? What exactly is being sought by the government here?
It's David. The government is seeking content. The original warrant also sought envelope information. That envelope information was provided by Microsoft because that information is available through something other than a warrant and was located in the United States. But with respect to email contents, that's where Microsoft drew the line, and it was with respect to that we filed our motion to quash the search warrant.
So is Microsoft's position then that the transmission data that it did divulge, that does qualify as a business record and is reachable that way? Was that the thinking on Microsoft's part?
I think essentially that's a good way of putting it, yes.
And, okay. and noting also that data was stored inside the United States, or at least some of that data was stored inside the United States, so there was no issue about these warrants, that warrant operating
extraterritorial. Yeah. Good. Two questions pending. Let's turn back to our audience.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Kent Huntington. I got a question for you, which follows up actually on that comment. Which is, I think, very important, the distinction between content and metadata. And my question is there really a line, is there something in the statute that I'm missing that really delineates the fact that metadata contains or may contain data in some sets or some subsets of information? And I go to this with some background at Justice previously, when we were just going to the court itself for information, and which were really, in my mind, somewhat of a rubber stamping process when even a warrant was issued. So are we talking about a difference without distinction? And if you could speak to that issue and clarify it a little bit more in my mind with what is on the books, at least what is statutorily in black and white.
Sure. So I'll start, and David, please chime in. This is Jim speaking. The part of the Electronic Communications Act that's relevant here, Kent, as you may know, is the Stored Communications Act, and that's found in Title 18 at Section 2702 and 2703, principally. And there is a very clear distinction in those provisions between the contents of communications and non-content, and that is data that is not the content of the communication. And that language in the statutes has been interpreted by the courts to mean basically that content includes, for email, the subject line of an email and the body of an email, and everything else is non-content. And non-content then sort of further subdivides into two subcategories. There's basic subscriber information, which is like the name and the date that you signed up and maybe your credit card information if you had to give a credit card. Other types of non-content information, and this is what you, I think, are talking about when you talk about metadata. That's stuff that is analogous in criminal investigations to what can be found on a pen register for a telephone trace, right? So that would be the date and the time stamp of an email. It would be perhaps the IP address of the user that's sending the email and the recipient of the email and other sort of transmission log information. That's deemed non-content susceptible access from the government by a D order, which David and I described earlier. I think your question tees up a really interesting issue in the law about sort of how big data and the collection of information that's really not even the contents of communications, but still very invasive or in a sense sort of relays an incredible amount of information about people can be used in accessed by the government, right? And this was the issue that Justice Sotomayor in her concurring opinion in the Jones case raised, where she questioned whether this so-called third-party doctrine under the Fourth Amendment is still viable, because so much information about people can be gleaned from data, even when it's not data as to which people have a reasonable expectation of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. And so I think we're going to see an evolution in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that gets at this issue about what metadata really is, and is there a meaningful distinction between metadata and content? I think it's a very good question, but as the statute is currently written, there is a very clear distinction.
What confidence do you have, I could just do one quick follow-up on my same point, that the content data isn't derived separately and then can be sought through a warrant which only seeks metadata? I mean, an investigation is prompt from information which, as you know, will not necessarily form the basis of the evidentiary foundation of an investigation. So there's two separate ways, obviously, to skin a cat many separate ways to skin a cat when the government leads you down the road of a government investigation. Do you have any thoughts on that and the confidence of, you know, playing defense against the big G government when you're holding only maybe most likely a subset of the cards which are already in their hands?
You mean, it's David, I'm taking your question to mean that once the government has the metadata, it can somehow gain access to the content information.
I'm saying that once they have the content information, they can separately find the information for a subset, which is just the metadata, knowing full well what the content is behind the screen. So actually the other way around.
Oh, I see. Well, I don't think that there's much. I think once they have the content information, they can easily get the metadata information, because I can't imagine them issuing a warrant that doesn't include that information. That doesn't seek that same information.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the holy grail for the government in these cases is the contents of the communications, and they sort of work their usual practices to work their way up the ladder, so to speak, of process to get the content. And often they'll use lesser forms of process to get metadata, which will then inform their probable cause application to the magistrate judge when they seek a warrant to get the content.
Thank you.
We've got one question pending. Let's take another call here.
Hi, this is Matt Ladd from M2 Systems, and I'm calling, or my question is more in regards on the cyber side of the house and how the law deals with that. In regards to the Fourth Amendment, if I am a client of Microsoft, and Microsoft believes that the mail is inherently mine, and they're just doing storage on my behalf. is the subpoena coming to me as a user and also to Microsoft, or does it only go to Microsoft?
It only goes to Microsoft.
So, I come from the IT side of the house, and a lot of times I hear we're also a Microsoft partner, so we sell Office 365. And one of the problems that I face dealing with an intelligent CIO is he's worried from a subpoena perspective that he would never have noticed, right? So the government would never put in notice that the subpoena, that they're under watch or investigation or whatever, whereas if they had an in-house Exchange server, that subpoena would then go directly to them. So I guess the question is, do you guys see moving forward on the law that should be something, if we inherently believe, and I know Microsoft believes this and other cloud companies believe this, that the data is the users and they're just storing, and if it's not a FISA request, right, so let's say it's just a static Fourth Amendment request, if that request is coming in, should the request either go directly to the user or to the user and Microsoft?
This is Jim. I think it's a great question, Matt, and it's a complicated answer. So for cloud customers storing data, you know, in the cloud, I think our view is that as close as possible, the process the government used to obtain evidence should mirror what it would do if the data were stored locally on a server in the company's server room, and that it's sort of the fortuity of the fact that the customer is storing its data in the cloud should not create should not be exploited by law enforcement to obtain data that it wouldn't be able to obtain if the data were stored locally. Now, the response that the Justice Department has to that is that, look, you know, in some cases, a big maybe for a giant enterprise customer with thousands and thousands of employees, that it's perfectly fine for the government to go to the general counsel of that company or to the head of security or something and serve process directly without putting at risk the integrity of the investigation. But that for some other companies that where there's really a concern about the risk of spoliation of evidence, it's the only way the government's going to get the information without risking putting at risk its investigation is to go to the third-party cloud provider. But we think that should be the exception and not the rule, and that there should be a strong presumption in favor of going to the customer first, and that the government ought to have to show that it has good reason when it doesn't do that before it uses compulsory processes and directs it at the cloud providers like Microsoft. I don't know, David.
And I'll take that one step further, Jim. It's David. By saying that we've actually litigated that issue, as you know. And, you know, the government last year served on us a notice to obtain an email account that was an Office 365 email that belonged to one of our corporate clients for one particular subscriber, one particular employee. And we brought a case that would have required the government to provide notice and to go directly to the enterprise rather than come to Microsoft. The details of that case are under seal, unfortunately, so we can't get into them. But the bottom line was that the government agreed in that situation to go directly to the enterprise rather than getting the information from us.
And just as a follow-up to that, if and this might pertain strictly to Microsoft because you're the one that's on the call, David, but if you are in the Ireland scenario, do you have any internal process that would require you to notify the user, right? Taking FISA out of this, right, because it's kind of a separate issue. But if it's just a typical, the government is pushing a search warrant to you guys, would you ever in any scenario notify the user?
Well, usually when the government pushes a search warrant to us, there's a specific request not to notify the user.
Yeah,
an order not to do so.
Right.
So we don't have much of a choice in that situation. Our preference, obviously, where we could, would be to notify the user.
That just seems so inherently against your Fourth Amendment rights. Thank you, guys. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Matt.
Let me make one more call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 5 minutes left here. Let me see if we see any more questions. Seeing none right now, let me ask a question. We've been talking a lot about ECBA passed in 1986. One or both of you have mentioned a legislative fix here, an opportunity to clarify things. We talked about a little bit about a proposal, a bill by Senator Orrin Hatch. And one of you alluded to sort of the institutional inertia being a hurdle to get over here, just the fact that it's difficult for Congress to pass bills and have the president sign them. Beyond that, is there, you know, concerted opposition to clarifying things legislatively? Is law enforcement opposed? Is Department of Homeland Security opposed? Is there, you know, organized opposition to clarifying the law, or is it just about the finer points of how to clarify the law?
Well, you know, if the government's it's David. If the government's opposition to our brief and lawsuit is any indication, then I would expect that they will be opposed to clarifying the law in a way that makes it more difficult for them to get information from outside the United States. I mean, I think the government's default position generally in these situations, frankly, is, you know, we want a world in which it is as easy as possible for us to get the information that we need to conduct investigations. But of course, we have a Fourth Amendment, and we have a need to balance the interests of privacy against the interests of the government. And so, you know, our view is that we need legislation to be able to do that. I can't really comment on how things will shake out in Congress, and I will say that I think that there is a surprising amount of support for reform in this area that really does cross party lines. And so, you know, I'm very optimistic that if a bill gets proposed, you know, we really have a shot to get something passed here.
We've got 2 minutes pending, and now another question from our audience. Let's try and get this final question in.
I was once subpoenaed to testify in an IRS investigation, and I told them that without a court order, that was a mere invitation, and I wasn't going to comply with it. And I advised the person who was the subject of the investigation, and he put in a motion to quash, which lost, and then I still declined to reply because the court had declined to rule on the validity of their request. I presume that without a court order, the IRS, Microsoft would ignore such an IRS request, or at least advise the subject. Is that correct?
If Microsoft receives a subpoena for information, relating
IRS.
To your email account, you mean?
Yeah, I suppose that's what they would be subpoenaing. Yeah.
If they're, you know, our position is that if they want, our position is that we'll comply with the law. So, you know, if you're located in the United States and the data center is located in the United States and they serve us a warrant seeking that in which a neutral and detached magistrate has made a finding of probable cause to get your email contents, then we'll produce them. We're going to hold them to what we believe and what the courts have said is the law in these situations.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter once again. My thanks to James Garland, Covington and Burling, and David Howard of Microsoft. This has been a fascinating discussion. Our audience was well engaged. I want to thank them as well for dialing in. And a reminder to our audience that our next scheduled Teleform conference calls tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the latest developments at the CFPB. And for a schedule of other upcoming calls, please visit the Federalist Society's website. But until that next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast.
For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.